You know, if you want to be really an entrepreneur, you have to deal with being uncomfortable while getting comfortable, and have ambition, but also be paranoid. Have patience, at the same time, perseverance. A lot of these skills need to come together. I think it's a world of contrast. Every operations team thinks they have the most simplified process. Convincing them for simplicity, they think we are already very simple. It's very hard to convince IT team on technology. It's very hard to convince HR team to pay for it and ops team to simplify it. I would highly discourage founders to sell to multiple personas, multiple buyers, or multiple stakeholders. The difference between a good company to great company is great companies provide exceptional support after purchase. Most companies provide a good support before purchase. That's why we hate like a lot of things that we buy even as individuals. Pricing reflects the conviction of the product builders in their product. If you truly believe you are creating value, you actually demand more versus if you think you are not creating enough value, where you probably say buy for $1 per user per month.
My next guest on the 1% Project is Vijay Raipathi, the CEO and co-founder of Atomic Work, a startup that helps enterprises bring their employees, IT systems, and HR operations together to drive business impact across the organization. Vijay's entrepreneurial journey kicked off with a food delivery startup that failed early on, and then he co-founded Minjar, a cloud management startup, which was acquired by Nutanix in 2018. Vijay's journey is a testament to grit, patience, and perseverance. From his early life in a small town in Andhra Pradesh in India to becoming a prominent entrepreneur, he shares his counterintuitive insights on entrepreneurship, the importance of people's success, and his passion for seeding and building new ideas. Join us as we explore Vijay's journey from his roots in a small town to his role as a leader in the tech industry. Subscribe to the show wherever you're listening to it and sign up to the 1% Project's Think newsletter at 1%.live for curated content that adds value to your professional and personal development. Stay till the end where I summarize the key takeaways from this conversation with Vijay. We kick this off asking him what has been the influence of his mother in his career and in his life.
She was probably the most influential person in my life. She grew up in a fairly well-off family, but by the time she turned around 10 or so, they lost most of the wealth. She went from, you know, okay to do to abject poverty, and then got married fairly early, and then moved from Andhra to Karnataka because she married my dad. Came to this village that had no road, no electricity, no telephone, no TV, no newspaper, not even a radio. So I think my mom was the first person who probably purchased a radio in that village. Okay. And she was the only one who could write letters. At that time, letter is a way of communicating because I knew everybody used to reach out to her in the evening asking her to draft the letters. And she was probably the only person who could do math in terms of 77 paddy bags into 180 rupees per bag. That was the cost it used to be in my childhood. So I was very fascinated why everybody was reaching out to her and how come she's so smart. Because I didn't know that she didn't have a great education. I think she probably just got to middle school, not even high school. But she was also like a great reader. She had one big trunk of books and she told me that was the only thing she carried when she migrated. I think when I was a small kid, it was like a lot of curiosity. And as I went to study with my aunt, and she was always the motivating person. And even when I went to go and do business, we don't come from a business family. So we come from like an agriculture family, and business is like an alien concept, especially from an India context where people think business is not for good people. This is for bad people. She always basically said, hey, it's okay to do business and you should consider doing business or doing something on your own, because her grandfather used to be a trader who used to trade with Burma and Kolkata and, you know, a bunch of coastal places. He didn't study anything, but, you know, he really built this good business of trading and going to territories where you don't know the language and still build relationship. And that's how she used to be very proud of her grandfather. So that was like a big influence why I ended up considering doing business, or at least starting up, and then taking a formal full-time job.
And from that village, which is 400 kilometers from Bangalore to Atomic Work, how has that journey been for you?
I'm actually grateful how life turned out to be for me. The reason why I say basically grateful is there are so many people along the way who played a pivotal role. My mom's younger sister, who was super instrumental in enabling me, my sister, even my younger brother, to have an opportunity to get educated. Because this village, as I said, no school. I mean, like, you won't believe the first road, proper road to this village happened less than 10 years ago. I mean, if it rains, you just can't walk because it's a mud. The concept of using shoe or slipper is like very alien to me, because in a mud road, there is no way you can actually use any. But I think my aunt, I think she played a significant role in helping us selflessly to get educated. And after that, a bunch of friends in the college who always encouraged me to do more, because they always used to think I'm smarter than even I used to think I am. You know, then when I went to work at a few places, there are people who basically said, hey, you actually deserve something better than this place. I think you should go to Bangalore. When I came to Bangalore, people who hosted me and really took me to introduce me to what I call the super early ecosystem of Bangalore at that point. To a lot of people, so I think a lot of times we underestimate people, strangers, events, how much they influence our trajectory. That's one of the reasons why, you know, I am a big believer in pay it forward.
It's fascinating, right? How powerful our network can be. Yeah. And if they believe in you, it can take you from X to Y, which is exponentially bigger.
Absolutely. I think that's why people say this thing. When you truly want something, the universe will conspire to make it happen for you. It's not really the universe. The universe for me is the people around us, because they either feel very pity that, hey, we have to help this person, or they believe that somebody else can help us because they see that passion in us or that hunger in us, or they have this blind belief that, okay, he or she can actually do it.
In your school in Hyderabad, you got bullied because of your height, and you were the youngest kid in class as well. So how did that play out?
The reason I ended up being the youngest kid in my school was, as I said, I went from village to a town near Hyderabad. I didn't have a formal education certificate. So the way things work in India is you need a proof that you study. I didn't even knew that people would ask, because I was like fairly young. My aunt and my uncle, they took me, and my uncle used to come to me with the schools to get me admitted, and everybody refused an admission into fourth grade because they believed that I didn't have a whatever study certificate. But everybody offered. There were like a lot of kind people who offered me, you can get started with first standard. But I basically thought, oh, I studied for 4 years in this village. I know basic alphabets, basic math, and you know whatnot. So I don't want to go back to first standard. So I had this opportunity. A teacher encouraged me to go write seventh exam, because seventh used to be a board exam in early 90s. She said, if you clear it, you essentially get a piece of certificate from government saying, okay, he did seventh, so you can go back to school. So because of that, I skipped a couple of years of formal schooling. So you go to eighth grade where, you know, because you are like 2-3 years younger to most kids in that class, so you are like shorter. So the thing people do if you are like the youngest kid, the shortest kid, the weakest kid is, you know, try to bully you. And so it happened to me. And that's probably one of the reason was also I used to spend most of the time in the library, in the school library, rather very away from the classes as much as possible, because I didn't want to deal with these people. But it also taught me like some survival skills, essentially how you make friends. When nobody wants to be your friend because you're not considered equal. And I think my mom basically told, if you really study well and if you top your class, maybe some of them want to be your friends. They started slowly, like, you know, when I got to, I think, my ninth grade, I kind of made like a couple of friends around 10th grade because they thought, you know, he's a kid who studies well, so let's not bother him. But there will be some people who, irrespective of it, you know, they just want to bully you. That time it used to be very painful. If you ask me, I used to cry a lot. And I also used to like have this, you know, underdog kind of a thing, go just fight with people. And even though I was not physically capable of doing that, but somewhere you have this, I really want to punch back. I really want to push back. But now if I look back, most of the times I smile. And I also think, you know, it's okay, because when I started companies, I ended up hiring people who are like much older to me. And, you know, that experience probably helped me later.
So moving from school to career, career started TCS, and from there to a failed startup, to another startup, which almost failed, then got acquired, and then to Atomic Work. How has that journey been?
Personally, it's been a journey of growth, an immense journey of compressed learning, and a lot of gratitude to people who really helped along the way. I went to TCS Michelin. They had this joint venture where we used to build software for them, for Michelin in France. And the project was, I had to build some 50 APIs in a year, right? So the way they scoped out is you build one API per week. But by then already I was hooked into a little bit open source from college days, discovered this tool which translates WSDL definitions to web services automatically. You just run the tool, give the spec, it will generate the code for you. I kind of did that in a month or so. Even then I didn't have much to do because they didn't expect that somebody can do it in a short span. It's not like I wrote the entire code. It's just that I used a tool to generate like most of that code. I got bored, and then a couple of friends there encouraged that, look, dude, for you, your kind of talent, this is probably not the place. They said, look, you will be dissatisfied here because you want to do a lot. Because I used to write code for them, fix things for them, which was a habit that I developed to make money when I was in college. So the college that I went to in Hyderabad, most people go to US for their master's or PhD programs. Some of them used to outsource their work back to me because they can't either code it up or they don't have time. And initially I did pro bono, then they started giving me some money, then I turned it into a way to make money. So I continued doing that even after college. That's how I pulled together some money to even make an attempt to do my first startup. I think my dad was dead against because he's, are you mad or not? What is this startup? You got a Tata is such a great place. You can just spend time there. But my mom basically said, look, if you really want to do something, maybe you can try. I used all these savings to try building this food delivery business in Bangalore. It didn't work out. It didn't work out because, one, we didn't have any understanding. The only thing I knew was how to write code. No understanding of business, no understanding of logistics, no understanding of capital it takes. We also thought, oh, we have 10 lakhs, and that's more than enough for us to go build something. So it didn't work out. Then I shut down and took up a job to pay off some of the credit card debt, etc., that I've accumulated trying to do this first startup. But look, there were people who basically said, look, a lot of us are much more experienced than you, but we never had the courage to start. The fact that you started itself is like a great thing. Then I wrote a blog post about this failure, which kind of went viral at that time in Google Groups. So Google Group used to be the way most founders used to talk to each other, connect, and stuff. So it went viral in a couple of groups, and then a lot of people started reaching out and telling, okay, don't worry, most of the times things won't work. I think that was very reassuring, and that also enabled me to get connected to a few people, and who in turn then connected me to a few other people, which helped me co-found Minjar with my Anand and Prashant and other founding team. I think that failure was probably the reason why I got connected to a bunch of people in the ecosystem.
So let's take a step back. Why did you choose food tech or food delivery? Like, it's not that Zomato and Swiggy was like prolific in 2007.
So yeah, they were not there. So the reason why I started that was Pizza Hut started doing pizza deliveries in India around 2006. So I basically thought, why can't we do the same thing? And as entrepreneurs, we always think the timing is right. Many decent restaurants that time had landline telephone. They also had a desktop computer because the government, I think a couple of years ago, introduced VAT and few taxes and stuff. So, you know, many decent restaurants had a computer, a desktop-based computer. And Google started reaching out to people to organize their information. Otherwise, the only way the information was organized was you call the local yellow pages, which is like just dial kind of a thing, which started also aggregating this information. We basically thought, hey, a lot of times we were always wondered about okay, where do I go? What do I eat? Can I make a reservation? Can I get that food? So we basically thought the timing was right. What we underestimated was the capital it requires for you to do these deliveries. And one of the funny stories from that time was taking online payments in India. There was like literally one credit card processor who at least responded to us saying, okay, I can give you some APIs, etc. for you guys to integrate. But he said, how much are you planning to collect in a month? So I basically thought 3 lakhs. That's going to be like a big amount. I said 3 lakhs is what I'm going to collect. They said, okay, you have to do 3 lakhs deposit with us to allow you to collect 3 lakhs per month because they were worried about fraud. But yeah, it's not that long ago, 15, 16 years. I mean, it feels surreal to see what's happening now. I think most of the times when things fail, the founders who started those things always think everything is ready. But like, eventually, it also takes like a bunch of iterations. So after us, like a bunch of people came, there's a second iteration. Then this whole Swiggy, Zomato kind of thing happened. They're like essential services even for me today.
I was recently at a cousin's place in India and he lives in Bangalore. And I couldn't believe that the bell rang every 15, 20 minutes and Zomato, Amazon, Swiggy, it just doesn't stop.
Yeah, it's just unstoppable. I mean, what's happening in India in terms of this digitized commerce is unbelievable.
An interesting fact, I was doing an episode on Domino's. Domino's started their operations in 1995 in India. And I believe that they were the very first people who set up home delivery systems. You started in 2007, but Domino's came into the market, but obviously they had the money and the wherewithal to stand the test of time. But technically, they are probably the first people who started the concept.
No, that's actually true. So I think the first guys who started doing home deliveries is this around the street Kirana folks. In the morning, you tell them, please send these 2-3 things home. They just send it. And at the end of the month, they charge you. They maintain one hisab or whatever ledger of what you purchased and stuff. What technology in general, both internet and mobile and you know, the availability of logistics, allowed us to compress the time it takes to deliver things and also scale at which we can deliver things. Recently, one of the guests from US came home and it was early morning thing and we realized the milk was not there and we ordered it. We are just having a conversation. So ordered, he knows that we are ordering. We are having a conversation. Even before that conversation ended, the milk was here. So some of the deliveries in India now, even where I live, happen in 7 minutes, 6 minutes, which is like crazy. Of course, our parents think, why are you being so lazy? Why can't you just go out and bring it?
Having said that, you talked about Kiranas. Have you ever realized that how trust worked between them? I think hardly any of us or our parents ever tallied the ledger.
Yeah.
They said at the end of the month, your bill is, let's say, 1,000 rupees.
Yeah.
And you would just give that guy 1,000 rupees.
I think India is that way a very unique market. We are also a very high context culture. High context culture is like, where you have to know the person, know the language, and you know, you have to feel comfortable to get in. The thing with high context cultures is inherently there is a trust. So if you look at Japan or Korea or India or China, some of these very high context cultures, what is not great in high context cultures is we can't take direct feedback. We can't take very open communication. Everything is implicit, right? And so because of that shared context, I think the trust levels are very high generally. And it works both ways. If, let's say, this vegetable vendor or a Kirana vendor cheats you, then he loses lifetime business because he's hooked to that street of the city or that village. So he can never come and do business again. Generally, Indians are really good at whispering. Probably the news travels faster. So I think there is both sides incentives. On the other side, for us, if you don't pay the vendor, there is a shame associated. You don't want to be known as someone who takes things, don't pay back as a family, as an individual, because you can't shift houses. So the mobility was not there. Both for the vendor who is delivering, giving you these groceries for on a 30-day credit period, he didn't have mobility. And as a family, it's not like you're shifting houses every 6 months, every year. For most of us, you probably acknowledge this. For our parents and all, it's one house for 50 years or 40 years, right? So for you, it's a shame if you don't honor your commitment. So I think the system worked both ways. I think a lot of those things are still visible even today. So even if you're assuming you authenticate your credit card, when you take a trip, they never used to ask you to pay upfront. They will charge you at the end of the trip. If the credit card fails, the only way you can book the next trip is you pay the previous amount and book it, right? Now in India, probably they're asking you to pay upfront because they're measuring what it costs, because cash collection can impact potentially the business cash flows. But yeah, I think there is like so much we can learn from the traditional world of things, carry some of those things for the new world.
From Amigos to Minjar, firstly, why did you start Minjar? Secondly, what was the learning there?
So the reason I started Minjar was I always felt that there is unfinished business. So building product is not enough. You have to build business. So my unfinished business was, hey, we have to build business. So I basically thought, okay, let me go make another attempt. But for that attempt, I basically thought, okay, I have to first pay off these debts that were lingering. I accumulated like credit card debt and it was pretty bad because credit card interest rates are like insane. Even if you pay more than minimum, it takes years and years for you to pay off. So I probably accumulated like ₹1 million, which is like a 10 lakhs or so credit card debt, which is like a fairly high debt, and took a couple of years to essentially pay off that and also take care of some things on the family side. Anand, my co-founder, and Prashant, I used to work, you know, Anand as a CTO. Anand used to be CEO at Kuliza. And me and Anand and Prashant, we took a step back and said, okay, we need to actually go build a different kind of a company. And that company could be Minjar. So where I become like a CEO and Anand become like a COO. The big lesson there was, you know, when things work out, they really work out well for you. So what happened was when we started Minjar, the public cloud just started taking off. We were like one of the earliest folks who were doing like building product against public cloud. When everybody used to think, what if Amazon steals my data, or can I really put my database there? The network is not stable. But I previously had experience building against public cloud services. So in 2006, I had to do one project for a large financial institution in US where the job was to process their transactions. In order to process their transactions across the worldwide, because they're a financial institution, so they have transactions in New York, in London, in Hong Kong, and Bombay. So you have to bring all of them and process them, right, at the end of the day for reconciliation. Now, in order to do that, we had to build a distributed file system. So we built a very simple distributed file system that can replicate data between multiple servers. When this cloud started emerging, especially the object storage of S3, was like a big aha moment for me. I'm like, okay, next time when I need to build this kind of a data analytics or data processing system, I don't need to build a file system. I can just go build on top of it. So that was like a learning that I kind of had. And I basically felt this is a super promising technology as a developer, as an engineer. So maybe more and more people will adopt. I think that assumption has worked out. So the big lesson there is when timing works out, you can actually build a really good company, sometimes even a great company. I think Minjar worked out for us, despite a lot of challenges of convincing investors to give money for an infrastructure software company. Because in India, nobody believed at that time you should go build infrastructure software. So people were super excited about e-commerce software. There were like even instances where people offered me money to shut down this, just go back, build an e-commerce company. And then they thought, okay, maybe we can replicate a low-cost application software. They thought building infrastructure software is a high friction. It takes long time to sell. It requires compliances. So why do you want to get into that game when there is an easier game to play? But we basically thought, okay, this is something that is super aligned to our skills as engineers. And two, we basically thought it is very promising from a personal experience standpoint. And three, we thought, okay, we saw also like a bunch of other friends and some of these e-commerce companies themselves started using public cloud for supporting their scale, supporting their elasticity, because they used to run these campaigns for Diwali, Dasra, New Year, Christmas, whatnot, the Black Friday equivalent of India. Then they were started using more and more of public cloud infrastructure. Then we found traction because of that. And eventually it was a great outcome for all of us. For 10 years, you struggle, nothing happens for you. Then suddenly you are able to take care of yourself because of really good financial outcome. So in our case, that really freed us up as a founders. And it was like a huge mountain of a burden on my shoulders as a founder and CEO, because when you try for 10, 12 years. And even though you're making progress, the system works in India in a way that you have to get married, you have to buy a house, you have to buy a car. And here you are still struggling for that $100, right? Because all your cash flows, anything that you have created our financial value stuck with the company. But when Nutanix decided to acquire us, that was like a fantastic outcome for all of us, like for us as a founders and also for founding team and everybody in the company.
Do you believe you are a serial entrepreneur?
I don't know like the criteria or the qualification for it, but generally founders, so whom do we call founders? Founders are people who are not just interested in tinkering with things, but also they are interested in commercializing those tinkering. I think most of us, I believe as founders, we get like a lot of energy in seeding things, maybe scaling them to a level. Some of us also like operating at scale and operating, you know, at an accelerated scale. But many founders, at least I have seen from my network, they don't like after some scale. So I have friends like, who build companies to pre-IPO, even to post-IPO. And they basically say, okay, I'm not interested in this post-IPO company. But when everybody in the world will be like, okay, that's a fantastic opportunity to build with public, in the public market. But some, they might not enjoy it because now you are no longer doing creation, which is the first love of most founders. I think for me, I like seeding things. So if you ask me why you started again instead of retiring, or doing something else, investing or some other job, I would simply say I love seeding things and refining things and maybe even taking them to scale. I got like a lot of job opportunities after 3 plus years at Nutanix. People used to reach out to me saying, I have this $500 million business unit or $1 billion business unit. I'm looking for a general manager to manage it. You know, it has a decent growth. There is a 10% growth, some cases 15% growth. But I never considered. Once recruiter actually responded back to me saying, this will pay you a lot of money. I basically said, I really appreciate it, but I'm not the person who is interested in just operating things. So that was probably a trigger for me to consider doing one more. And as I said, I'm just getting close to 40. I still believe there is a runway for me to go and at least make an attempt and just enjoy the process.
Atomic Work. Why should anybody care about it?
Great question. When we thought of starting a company, me, Kiran, Parsu, my co-founders, so initially we didn't have any idea. Initially we thought, okay, we should, all of us together should spend time, really ask ourselves, do we really want to do a company? If we want to do a company, you know, are we willing to commit personally another 10 years of our life when we are already financially independent? So if you ask me, my financial dream when I was in college was to make 1 crore. Which is at that point probably like $300,000 or so. Today it is probably less than $200,000. The idea was, okay, I make 1 crore, build a house with 25 lakhs, buy a few acres of land with another 25, 30 lakhs, put 25 lakhs in FD or in some investment, just have a peaceful life. Because we all came from these villages. So in village, if you have a 5 lakhs or 10 lakhs, you're already considered as a wealthy person. If you have few acres of land, and then few lakhs of money, people consider you are very rich. If you have a crore of money, which is like a 10 million Indian rupees, you are like extremely wealthy. So my reference point was, let's make a crore and just retire. So this was like when I just went to college, like the first year of college, you know, in my head was like, okay, just let's make a crore, it's enough. But then I realized, look, it's not about money, because after Minjar exit also, I deeply thought about it. Should I really be in this race to say, I want to go build one more company? Why not actually just do things I really love doing? Then when I started thinking about things I love doing, then I realized the most important thing I love doing is actually seeding new things, seeding new ideas and tinkering with them and refining them. And selling them. So I basically said, okay, if that's the thing I like, then probably I should actually make one more attempt before I say, okay, I'll buy a beach house and just read books. And I seriously considered just, why not just read books? But I think one of my mentors, Sharad Sharma, said the first 25 years, you have to give it to yourself to skill yourself. The next 25 years, you work, you do whatever business, or you create value through your skills. to create comfort for your family, because there is a person probably who trusted you, married you, you know, you probably have kids, you have some elderly parents to take care. So the next 25 years, focus on that. The last 25, you must give it to community and country. So having said all this, so we were basically in dilemma of all this. And then we said, okay, what happens when we start companies? So everyone starts company with a belief that I want to grow this company. You grow the company and the growth brings complexity. In order to manage complexity, you create processes, right? Now, in order to manage those processes, you hire people just to manage processes. So that's how, as humans, we invented front office, back office, support, all these functional roles. Then we basically realized that humans can only do so much, so we need to put a software to manage these processes. That's where we have all these softwares to manage payroll, people, leaves, internal support, internal process automation, expense reimbursement, vendor management, procurement, and whatnot. And then we basically realized that when you put these processes and like a lot of different tools, it is actually slowing down the execution. And now you start integrating these tools together to say, we have to deliver a simplified experience so people can actually get the internal work done so that they can actually focus on doing the customer work, which is the reason for survival of any company. Now we basically said, okay, you start a company, you grow the company, the growth brings complexity, and that complexity requires process management. That process management today is inefficient because of a lot of tools, like a lot of dissimilarities and data silos, etc. And that actually causes friction. And this friction leads people like us to leave companies, saying, okay, we don't want to be in a big company. So we said, why don't we build a software to essentially unify these internal processes and reduce the friction? Then maybe companies, even at a scale, might be fun. My co-founders also have went from the startup to a very big company, Freshworks, where they were like very, very early. So I think Kiran and Parsu are like third or fourth employees or fourth and fifth employees at the company. Think of like from that journey to going to a few thousand people. And then I went from like few hundred people to a few thousand people company. And that was like two and a half thousand people company to it went to 7,000-8,000 people company as Nutanix. So I have seen how complex, you know, the internal work will get when companies grow. So the reason we basically thought was, if we build this company, maybe it can help other people build companies without hating the same company that they started. If I talk to a lot of founders, you also, like when you talk to founders, they don't like the company that they created once it becomes really big company. When I say really big, when it becomes like 5,000 people, 10,000 people company, they say, boss, if you ask them, would you join this company today? Publicly, they might say yes, but privately, if you ask in a friendly conversation, they will say no. Why? They say, I don't like the HR, I don't like the culture, I don't like the complexity, I can't get anything done, because there is too much friction, internal friction. The internal friction came from process management, came from scale. So if you ask me why we are super excited to work on this, is not only we should build companies, we should build a company and build software, but our things should become like an operating system for other people to build companies and manage the growth and scale and complexity of their internal work, internal operations, internal support, their employee experience, all these aspects.
You work with different teams and different heads, HR, IT, and operations.
Yeah.
Which team is the hardest to convince?
I think every operations team thinks they have the most simplified process. Convincing them for simplicity, they think we are already very simple. It's very hard to convince IT team on technology. It's very hard to convince HR team to pay for it and ops team to simplify it. And generally, when you have to bring 3-4 people together to make a decision, now it's no longer about your software. It is about them coming together and aligning them. So that's one of the reasons why we also basically said, look, from day one, we can't basically go and say we solve everybody's problem in a company. I think we have to insert at one place all that problem, then expand from there to really fulfill this vision. So I would highly discourage founders to sell to multiple personas, multiple buyers, or multiple stakeholders. So you really, really have to have one decision maker who decides, do I want to buy this and use this? Maybe the user could be different in a business context. The buyer need not be the user. Because as a startup, you don't want to deal with their politics, their dynamics, their egos at play. Because as a human, if I pitch for a product, somebody might say, okay, that's good for you, but it's not good from IT perspective. Where IT pitches it from their perspective, somebody might come and say, it's good from an IT side, but you are never thinking from a business perspective.
The kind of business that you are in.
Yeah.
Do you think it's an inbound business or an outbound business?
Great question, right? So I always believe every company, right, has both inbound and outbound, but we also like kind of diluted some of these definitions, right? For most of us, inbound means somebody coming to your website, signing up, and trying your product, and then buying your product. That's how at least SaaS folks have diluted. For me, inbound is also about your brand. So why do you go sign up or decide to open a bank account with a specific bank when there are 5 banks out there? You heard them, you probably saw their campaign, probably they're offering a good mobile app that one of your friends said it's a much better mobile app compared to bank B or bank C. So I think every business has both inbound and outbound, but I genuinely believe in outbound. The reason why I basically say in outbound is even a great products will not be purchased if you don't package them well, if you don't position them in the marketplace, if you don't price them, if you don't give a great experience for them, not just before buy, after buy. The difference between a good company to great company is great companies provide exceptional support after purchase. Most companies provide a good support before purchase. That's why we hate like a lot of things that we buy even as individuals, which is also true in a business context when you buy B2B software. And then the reason I also basically say you have to go is it's a super competitive world. So if you asked our grandfathers, they would say it's a super competitive world to do agriculture because everybody is growing it. And today for us, the agriculture that we are doing is creating software, distributing it. They used to go to a marketplace to sell it, which is a physical marketplace. Now we are selling it in a digital marketplace. Now you have to tell, even my dad used to tell me, I used to tell I make the best paddy because I use the least fertilizers. He used to use fertilizers, not like he never used fertilizers. And he would dry them, then package them, then take it to this physical marketplace to sell it. A lot of people don't even dry it. So his pitch point was, look, I dry. And if you want to verify, you talk to anyone in my village, they will tell. I am like one of those farmers who just follows the good practices. Because he dries it, he can wait to sell it if the price is not good currently. So I can wait in another month, another week, another couple of months. You know, we are now selling in a digital marketplace. But going away from this analogy, the reason why I say outbound is, nobody wakes up, especially from a business to business software perspective. Nobody wakes up their Monday morning or Friday evening to say, let me go search and buy software, which essentially means as a company, you have to create awareness about the problem that you're going after, how uniquely you are going after that problem, and why they should probably take a bet on you. Probably you basically say, look, I'm applying AI, or I have the best customer support. Right? Or everybody who bought this software loves us. If you want, we are competitive. We won't fleece you with our pricing or with our renewals. And so I basically believe you have to do inbound, you have to do outbound. And anyone who says I only do inbound, or anyone who only says I only do outbound, either they are like taking a very narrow view or they have not seen the full cycles. Look at the Apple, the product, how much advertising they do to target. They say you can take the best photos with it. They can't say this is better than Samsung, etc., because then people will compare the price. Okay, you are better, but maybe in some aspect, the price is like 3x, 4x. But you play to the emotional needs of people. So they basically, these days, when you go to airport, they pitch privacy. Because anybody who is rich, the thing probably they care about is privacy. And it is one of those thin goods where, you know, with every year, the price is increasing. As the demand increases, the price also increases.
How do you think about pricing?
Great question. So I generally keep reading a lot of books on pricing. Everybody basically says, as a human being, we want the best product at the cheapest price, if not cheapest price, the best possible price, and have a great experience with it while using it. And if you have a problem, then we need someone to help us. So when you think of pricing your software, a lot of times we get obsessed about what competitor A is doing or B is doing. Maybe we price cheaper than them, then we can tell that we are the cheapest software. Or we basically price a little bit more than them, saying we are better than them, but when it comes to discounting, and I'll just give a discount, take the deal at any cost or whatever. For me, like, pricing reflects the conviction of the product builders in their product. If you truly believe you are creating value, you actually demand more versus if you think you are not creating enough value, where you probably say buy for $1 per user per month. That's why you have products do the same thing, who charge like $1 per month to probably charging $20 per month. The difference between them is the guy who charges or the company which charges $20 per month have to build a great product. Otherwise, nobody is going to pay $20 for a shitty product. So product design is important. The product has to work exceptionally well, because if it has friction, you're better off with a $1, $2 product rather than a $20 product. And it has to provide probably, if not $2,000 value, it at least has to provide $200 value to a person, the user. So for me, pricing is something that people should think even before they build a product. And pricing is something they should think, as I said, it reflects the conviction of the builders in their product. Right? The problem is if you price it too cheaply, you can't actually do the things that you need to do to support your users after they buy the product. Because if you're selling it for, let's say, $10 instead of $100 per user, how can you give them a human support? You essentially, through automation, the more the world gets automated, the more humans crave for human interaction, right? That's where we hate this bot interactions and this robotic assistance on the other side when you try to reach your bank or airline or e-commerce, etc. Long story short, I highly encourage founders to spend an enormous amount of time, not just on products, on distribution. The first aspect of distribution is, how are you going to package and price it?
You talked about AI. You talked about how people like it, dislike it. You've also mentioned that AI is the new SaaS, or generative AI is the new SaaS.
Yeah.
Can you double click on that?
I think, so as you can see from my bookshelves, so I'm like a big reader of history. Okay. And I always basically look at what are those exponential curves that generally accelerate the progress. Today, at least it looks like AI is one of those exponential curves. If you ask me, Vijay, why do you believe in it? I already see immediate value for me when I use some of these AI tools like ChatGPT, etc. And I also see that the use cases are expanding. So it's real and it's personalizable. And of course, it has its own quirks and whatnot. And most of us, at least in the tech world, if not from non-tech world, agree that it's an order 10 magnitude earthquake. That means most of the landscapes will be remade. So what happens when earthquake happens? Order 10, at least from history, we know that the landscapes will be remade. It can cause tectonic plate shifts. But we don't know which of those landscapes will be remade faster compared to some of other landscapes. That's why, as founders and investors, we are figuring out, okay, maybe this is an area where it will be remade much faster. So that's why people say content creation, creative tasks, basic task management, etc., right? Or L1 support, whether it's a customer or a technical. These are the jobs AI can easily take, or paralegal work, whatnot. Now, the reason I basically say AI is a new SaaS is because of this reason. We basically find immediate value. We are seeing expansion in the value as these things are getting fast, better. And we believe that there is an exponential value of this. So from internet, all of us learned that the cost of distribution has dramatically has come down. One of the things, at least internet enabled, if not for all businesses, for many businesses, it has reduced the cost of distribution. But the cost of creation is still the same. Now, with AI, you know, you potentially the cost of creation can dramatically go down. The cost of creation for a software engineer is code generation. For a marketing person, you know, it is writing copy or coming up with creative ideas, etc. For a salesperson, it's a better intelligence about prospect, their usage, based on the interactions of customer. Can I price this, not price this? Is there a deal or no deal? So I think for a lot of these things, AI can potentially help us. Now, because of that, I genuinely believe the new SaaS is AI, in a B2B context, because AI, we also believe that it can help drive significant productivity for a lot of things. Let's say you have created an email. Most of us, any thoughtful business person, would spend 5 minutes, 10 minutes, even sometimes half an hour, just trying to review it. And before you just push the send, right? Because you don't want to send a mail that has spelling mistakes or that is not well formatted, that doesn't bring out the essence. Today, that 3 minutes or 30 minutes is becoming 3 seconds to 30 seconds because of AI. So there is significant productivity gain for you. So there are like a lot of these small trivial things which can actually drive productivity gains. Because of that, B2B software is always about productivity. What is software? Software is either increasing productivity at an individual level or delivering efficiency at an organization level. The difference between productivity and efficiency is productivity is mostly tracked at an individual level or a team level. Efficiency is tracked at a company level. Now, we always use software to improve productivity or efficiency. Because of that, you make more money or you spend less money. Because of that, you basically believe that there is a gain. That's why people pay for software, right? In a business context. AI now can essentially accelerate this. So I think from a B2B perspective, we know that it's a productivity accelerator. From a B2C, it's probably personalization. Like a lot of softwares, whatever, some social networks personalize things for you, e-commerce things personalize for you. Even today, a lot of B2C software is not personalized for you. And AI can potentially help us personalize a lot of software from a B2C perspective, and from a B2B perspective, drive extreme productivity. And hopefully, my only skepticism is generally as technologists and people, as engineers, I would say, more than technologists, we overestimate impact of technology in a short run and underestimate its impact in a long run.
Your views on generalists versus specialists?
So I think startups need a lot of generalists because seeding generalists are really good at seeding things, tinkering things, moving fast, having a breadth. But scaling requires a lot of depth. If you have a scale company, you end up hiring specialists to scale things. But at startups, you mostly hire generalists who have that ability to do things beyond their job. I think specialization is extremely good when you get to scale.
Counterintuitive insights about entrepreneurship.
I think what looks rosy from outside is not rosy once you're an entrepreneur. But what probably looks like, oh, too much pain or too much risk, that probably not that much risk, that much pain once you're an entrepreneur. And the big thing is if you want to be really an entrepreneur, you have to deal with being uncomfortable while getting comfortable and have ambition, but also be paranoid. Have patience, at the same time, perseverance. A lot of these skills need to come together. I think it's a world of contrast, I would say. What looks great from outside of being an entrepreneur is not great, but what looks from outside not great of being an entrepreneur is probably not that bad.
You have had 3 companies now. And obviously, there have been tough times. What has been that one thing that you did or helped you get through your self-doubt that you would have again and again?
I think if you had asked me this even a few years ago, probably I would not have been able to articulate. But I think these days, I feel this two-piece, the patience and perseverance. See, patience is like a passive skill. It's your ability to stay put. Perseverance is like an active skill, your ability to keep doing, keep contributing to make progress. So I think probably this both of these things have helped because a lot of people say you have patience and you also don't give up. I think I was reading one of the book, I forgot name of the book. It is about entrepreneurship. So they did like some research and then published. So there is one para at the preface which basically says the difference between the successful entrepreneurs versus the ones who gave up is that last bit of perseverance and patience. When you think, okay, this is it, this is the end, you're done, and you give up, versus the people who basically say, maybe, you know, I'll just make that last one push, and you continue to do that. That's why when you go read all the successful entrepreneurial stories, everybody says, okay, we are on the verge of bankruptcy, verge of shutting down, on the verge of thinking, okay, this thing is not going to work.
3 books or blogs that have transformed your life.
I really love this book written by the Durants called Lessons of History or Lessons from History. It's a great book to read. It talks about like from like millions of years to 10,000 years to, you know, 500 years, etc. The second book that I really like is by this Professor Vaclav Smil called Energy and Civilization. It essentially talks about how energy is a universal currency. And our ability to harness energy is actually what drove civilizational progress and continue to drive civilizational progress. It's a fascinating book. I would highly encourage folks who are interested in history to read it. Third one, I think like a lot of books can compete for third position, but if I have to say again, Homo Sapiens, it's a great book because I believe reading history gives us comfort. From comfort, courage, you can have some courage. And when you have courage, you take more risk. So especially if you're in entrepreneurship, what you need is comfort, courage, and these two things can give you like a lot of risk-taking ability.
Because you're a reader of history, if I had to ask you one person from history you would like to meet, who would that be?
Oh my God. So probably Tesla, I would say from a recent modern kind of history. And if I have to go beyond that, I also like both Alexander and Genghis Khan for like just the sheer ambition and audacity and the perseverance to take such a long expeditions. Like when logistics was a nightmare, just convincing small groups to work together itself was a nightmare. I think these are the three people I would basically.
One advice to your younger self.
I'm generally restless. I would say breathe more. Just pause and breathe. Generally, you know, I was always this restless person to get things done. These days, I'm telling myself, again and again, pause, breathe, because that reflection is a great value creator for me to make probably a better and faster progress.
Vijay, that's a great place to close the conversation. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed chatting with you and I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you, Pratish.
Hope you enjoyed the conversation with Vijay. Here are the key takeaways. Number one. Resilience is a transformative power, and if one has the ability to leverage experiences, including failures, it can be a catalyst to success. As long as one is willing to adapt, learn, and seek opportunities, even in the face of setbacks, they will exceed. Number two, trust is deeply embedded in high-context cultures like India, where personal relationships, mutual understanding, and implicit communication play a pivotal role in businesses. Number three, pricing should reflect the product builder's conviction in the product. Pricing just isn't about trying to undercut competitors or offering discounts, but it should rather be based on a genuine belief of its builder in the value the product provides. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with someone who will find it valuable. For any recommendations and feedback, you can drop me a line at pritish@1%.live. The email is in the show notes. Until next time. You can find the show notes for this episode and every other episode on 1%.live. If you enjoyed this conversation, share it on social media and leave a review. See you next time.